Now, during now, it was interesting that you noted that during the Garrison investigation, the underground, they were sort of on Garrison's side.
Yeah, a lot of his former associates, people he involved with in the underground. First of all, Garrison was their knight in shining armor.
Yeah.
He was coming to bust the CIA and whoever for bringing down, you know, the hope of a generation, Kennedy. And so when, Kerry started, he got indicted by Garrison, was being, he felt unjustly persecuted, he basically became an enemy of Garrison, who was, the person that all the underground and the counterculture was promoting. So
yeah.
Kerry immediately found himself at odds with all the,
all the people he was associated with before.
Yeah, yeah. So that kind of led in, to a certain amount of alienation, which eventually, one could attribute to Kerry's growing paranoia and his eventual, mental breakdown.
Now, did he expect to be indicted in this Garrison thing, or was that like a total surprise to him at the time?
He said it was a total surprise.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And then after the fact, after he had adopted the conspiracy theory as opposed to what he thought originally, did he ever go back to Garrison and try and give him any more information maybe that he had held off before?
Well, yeah, that was the thing. He tried to set up a few meetings with Garrison so they could actually sit down and talk to it, but Garrison never agreed to meet him face to face. So he met with Garrison underlings, and the whole gist of the case was a lady named Barbara Reed claims that she saw both Oswald and Thornley together in New Orleans, and so when Thornley would meet with Garrison's people, and he'd tell him, no, I never met with Oswald, and they're going, you knew Oswald and the Marines, you wrote this book about him, you're living in New Orleans at the same time he is, this has to meet, be the most fantastic coincidence ever, or you're lying.
Yeah.
And, they just assumed he was lying, or, that was Garrison's assumption. He was basing a lot of his case on that, so they never wanted to hear Thornley out about it.
How come you think he never met with how come you think Garrison never met with Thornley? Was he just too busy, you think, or what?
Hard to say.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, Thornley, I noticed like how he changed from anti conspiracy theory to pro conspiracy theory, but also earlier in throughout his life, as you detail in the book, he seems to change ideologies like on a whim,
mm-hmm.
and then zealously dive into these ideologies.
Yeah.
Speak to that a little bit, because I thought that was kind of like, I wouldn't say strange, but I thought it was, a little odd. I was like, that's kind of, one day, he picks up an Ayn Rand book, and next thing you know, he's an ardent capitalist.
And, yeah.
So what do you think that was all about?
Well, have you ever picked up an Ayn Rand book?
No.
Oh, well, Yachty, you'll turn into an ardent capitalist.
Well, I picked up Atlas Shrugged, but it was really big.
Yeah.
I just didn't have the time, but I've heard really good things about that. And that's actually, I think, the book that Thornley read that turned him into an ardent capitalist.
Well, I think it was just a evolution that was going on with Thornley, and he was always open to new ideas, and he's one of those guys that got a certain idea or ideology or something would capture his imagination, and he would run with it for a while, then something new would turn up. And that, I'm kind of similar in that respect. When you get into looking at conspiracy theories and all these
yeah.
different things, that there's a period of time when you're going, wow, there's something to this, and it's just where you buy into it.
Yeah.
But then eventually you get to the point where, hey, I really don't know anything for sure in this world, and move on to the next thing. I think that Thornley was, you know, just had that adventurous nature and was an experimenter, and so, you know, he was continually evolving, as we all are, really. You know?
Yeah.
So I don't really think that was odd. Curie was definitely zealous and passionate about things, so when he would dive into a theory, he would definitely write it out and take it to the hilt.
Yeah, yeah. After he embraced this conspiracy idea behind the JFK assassination, obviously, that most people believe in now, he really plunged headlong into it, and then he started accusing his other Discordians of being his handlers and things. He really went off the deep end, so to speak, for once he got into that conspiracy aspect.
And, you know, you could attribute that to a few things. The more conspiracy-minded among us will say that he went off the deep end because he was a victim of mind control or whatever, or maybe he did too much acid or, you know, I think might have been a number of things, part of the alienation he felt and the persecution from the Garrison investigation. And I also document a long affair he had over many years that kind of came to an end at the same time as the whole Garrison investigation was ramping up. So, you know, there's many things you could contribute to his eventual breakdown. Yeah, but he did at one point really become an extreme paranoid and suspected members of the Discordian Society as kind of being involved. He felt that Robert Anton Wilson, of all people, was his CIA handler at one point, and the Discordian Society had, was basically a front for the CIA.
that's just, yeah, that just makes me laugh. Now, when
he was in, you know, it sounds totally ludicrous, but at one point, Curie bought into that, and he was in pretty bad shape. He eventually worked his way out of that funk, and I think had a pretty good life until he, you know, died in the late 90s.
Yeah. Now, when he was at his most paranoid, do you think the other Discordian members, when do you think he reached his nadir of paranoia?
It was around 76, 77, 78, I was able to lay my hands on a lot of the letters he wrote. I was fortunate enough to get a hold of Greg Hill's archives and Louise Lacey. You know, they all saved all these letters Stanley wrote, and, you know, they're just the classic case of, you know, full-blown paranoia exhibiting itself on, you know, on the written page.
Now, do you think that a lot of his old buddies from that time period, from the 60s, from the early days of the Discordians, and at that point it had been like over 10 years, do you think they had sort of grown up and moved on and started families and stuff like that, and he was...
They moved on, and they were doing different things, and Curie kind of got stuck in that whole paranoid conspiracy theory, you know, surrounding the Kennedy assassination, and he didn't evolve for a number of years, and so. But you know, there was a pretty close bonding with some of those folks, Greg Hill and Bob Newport and Louise Lacey, where they kind of watched over Curie in those years and took care of him and kind of nodded their heads and tried to be patient with him when he was going off the deep end.
Yeah, that's cool. It's nice that they...
he had a support group there that helped him through.
All right, because I had the fear that maybe they had sort of like just turned their back on him at that point because he was getting worse and worse, but it sounds like they were pretty cool to him.
Yeah.
Now, towards the end of the book, you say that, well, it seems that the idea that maybe he was schizophrenic comes up. What do you think that was? Do you think that was just people trying to place a label on him, maybe trying to figure out what made him so over-the-top paranoid, or do you think there was maybe some schizophrenia going on there?
Bob Newport, I've mentioned a couple times here, he was one of the original members of the Discordian Society, and he was also a clinical psychologist, and he diagnosed Carey as a paranoid schizophrenic. But, you know, it's pretty easy to pigeonhole people, and to quote Charles Manson, paranoia is a higher form of awareness. So I think, you know, Thornley might have been one of those people tuned into some higher frequencies, you know,
yeah,
that oftentimes geniuses are. The people who go crazy perhaps don't have the tools or don't learn to teach themselves ways to filter out too much of the noise so they can, you know, go on living day to day.
Yeah.
Now, make sense?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. Do you think he was, so you're saying,
But you
don't think he was, like, sick or anything like that? That, physically sick or anything like that, but, sort of like that he had an ailment that they could, that if he had gotten some kind of treatment during those days, maybe he would have been a little better off?
I think he eventually did get treatment. I mean, I've heard different things from different people, but Bob Newport's of the impression that eventually he did go on medication in his later years, and that really helped him out.
Yeah, because during this time, it's important to know that he was sort of a vagabond, which is when...
He was living in storm drains and hitchhiking across the country, and, you know, when he hit his lowest, he was doing what he could to survive, eating out of garbage cans,
yes,
this type of thing, which, you know, is pretty sad for a brilliant person like he was, but, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, life, it's a bitch.
Yeah.
Now, when you were writing the book or researching the book, did you ever meet Thornley?
I never did, unfortunately. I did correspond with him and talk to him on the phone, but we never met face to face, unfortunately.
And what was the?
I mean, by the time I started writing the book, he was dead. When I had conversations with him, correspondence, that was in the early 90s before I really had any intention of writing the books. And I got involved, you know, with the underground zine movement. You know, during a period of time, I was writing a lot of quote-unquote wacky people, you know, just networking with strange people, more out of amusement than anything, and Thornley was one of those people I made contact with.
And what was that correspondence like? Like, how did he look back on his life?
I think what I did was just send him some different articles. I think I sent him an article I'd written in Paranoia magazine kind of that claimed or entertained the theory that psychedelics had been introduced into the counterculture basically to undermine it, you know, by the CIA or whoever. And, you know, send stuff like that to Thornley just to get his feedback. I remember that particular piece he kind of called bullshit on, but in a nice and diplomatic way. So, you know, those were the kind of exchanges we were having.
Yeah.
Nothing that was, you know, directly talking about his life or anything. Like I said, once again, at that time I had no intention of writing a book about him.
So it was more like trying to get perspective from someone who was, like, on the scene when things were going down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, that's an important, you know, you want to get that kind of perspective. And you met a lot of these people who were in the Discordian Society after the fact, or correspond with him when you were writing the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Really, a lot of cool and interesting people. Got to go spend some time with Robert Anton Wilson, and actually Greg Bishop accompanied me on that assignment. That Wilson and Bob Newport showed up for that interview, and that's one of the highlights of my life, meeting somebody like Bob Wilson. That guy is a big hero of mine.
Well, why don't you speak to that a little bit, what it was like meeting him, and you just pick his brain for a while and stuff. Is it cool?
Oh, yeah. It's you know, he's just the ultimate gentleman. Invited us in, poured us a shot of scotch, and eventually got down to business, had some pizza with him, and stepped out on the porch and had a couple smokes, and you know, his intellect is staggering, and so I felt a bit overwhelmed. You know, what the hell is this guy talking to us for? But he, you know, he's a very down to earth guy too, and you know, made everybody at ease. Even though, you know, he's at the point of his life where he's having kind of some medical problems post polio, so he doesn't get around that well anymore. But
that sucks.
Yeah. Great guy. One of the thrills of my life.
Nice. Now, what about Thornley's son? Did he read the book? Did you talk to him when you were writing the book at all? Have you heard any feedback about, or also Thornley's ex-wife? Have either of those two had anything to say about the book?
I was in contact with Kira Thornley, his ex-wife, and his son, Craig, but they never did want to be interviewed. I think Craig was real wary of the whole thing, how a book on his dad was going to be handled. And also, Greg's an artist in his own right, a filmmaker. So I think in a certain respect, he's lived under the shadow of his father and his father's craziness. So
yeah.
He never wanted to get involved. Kira Thornley, I also pursued for quite some time, and I think there's a lot of old wounds there. She never consented to being interviewed, although, you know, both of them put me into contact with other folks. I had a lot of lengthy interviews with Carrie's brother, Dick Thornley, which were quite helpful.
Nice.
So, you know, you do the best you can, but it gets to the point where, you know, these people don't want to talk about this, so it's time to move on.
Yeah, you don't want to harass them or anything.
No.
Now, you obviously, throughout this, you must have done a lot of research on the JFK assassination, or you've probably done a lot of research on it.
Well, I had done a lot previously, back in the early 80s or so. I remember one incident in particular. I was going to a local JC, and this is I think late 70s, early 80s, sometime around there, and I saw a poster hung up there at the college saying the CIA killed JFK. I go, what in the hell is that about? I'd never been exposed to that before, so anyway, that got me looking into the Kennedy assassination, picked up one book and another, and after a while, it kind of spiraled out of control, but became an obsession. So, you know, I did a lot of reading and research over the years, and by the time I got around to writing the Thornley book, you know, that background helped out.
Yeah. And so you sound like you're a pretty well-read researcher. What, in a nutshell, what do you think the Kennedy assassination was all about? I mean, you've probably delved into a lot of research that especially with this like Hoffman style stuff and the revelation of method and maybe the mind control and the ritual aspect, where do you fall in the JFK assassination lore?
What I found interesting was when I found out the Beatles were in Dealey Plaza on the same day of the assassination.
Really?
And what I believe is that the four Beatles used a triangulation of gunfire to shoot down JFK. Actually, that was a theory put forward by Cliff Clavin on Cheers.
Oh, okay. Were they really in Dealey Plaza or no?
No.
I hope not. That would be even more bizarre than I could wrap my head around.
So you're asking me what I think.
I mean, everybody has their own sort of, anyone who's looked into the JFK assassination probably has their own perspective.
I think it was engineered at a very high level. Elements of, the government were involved. Also involved in the cover-up afterwards.
Yeah.
For a lot of reasons, I think, even though JFK got us heavily involved in Vietnam, he also put out an executive order shortly before his death, getting ready to pull all the advisors, as they called them, out of Vietnam and extricate ourselves from that whole mess. And, war is big business, and I think the military-industrial complex had such an interest in there that they couldn't...
They couldn't let that happen.
No, so they, took him down.
Yeah. Yeah, that seems to be pretty much the consensus point of view. What about the whole ritual aspect to the JFK assassination? A lot of people poo-poo that or sort of think that's obfuscation. I've heard people say that. So, I mean, do you pretty much create the ritual aspect, or do you think that's just finding things when you're looking for it?
Yes. But like I was saying before, it entertained various conspiracy theories, and there could be something to that. Once again, it's hard for me to buy in 100% to any one theory, but I don't disbelieve or poo-poo things either necessarily. Who knows? It certainly made entertaining reading.
That's for sure. Yeah, well, it's interesting. I always find that sort of aspect of the JFK assassination pretty interesting. You can't really totally prove it or anything, so it's hard to, you gotta file it away and be like, huh, that's another interesting log for the fire here.
Yeah.
Now, you dedicate the book to Jim Keith and Ron Bonds. Ron Bonds is a publisher who published the Carrie Thornley books and I think some of the Jim Keith books, right?
Oh, yeah. He was the major publisher for Jim Keith at Illuminate Press.
And were you friends with Jim Keith at all? Did you know him? Were you corresponding with him during the time?
I corresponded with him quite a bit over the years. We used to bounce things off of each other, and I felt he was a colleague, compadre. We never met, and we always had plans to meet at some point. Never did, unfortunately. Interestingly enough, like you're saying, Ron Bonds at Illuminate was Keith's major publisher before Keith died. He'd actually basically became a partner with Ron Bonds and was doing a lot more work with Illuminate Press.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so they were working closely together. Get the timeline here correct. Keith died before Ron Bonds did. Jim Keith went to a Burning Man Festival, which I've been to a couple times, and I'm trying to remember the year. It's around, I want to say, 97 or 98, and it fell off the stage there. Hurt his knee. Went in the next morning for some routine medical operation and ended up dying. And so a lot of people have, conspiracy researchers have, raised some curious eyebrows about that. Not long after, Ron Bonds ended up dying from food poisoning, which, also people like Ken Thomas at Steam Shovel Press thought was, once again, pretty damn curious.
Yeah, well, how well did you know Ron Bonds?
Once again, he was somebody I corresponded with on occasion. I pitched him some book ideas, and we exchanged information. he had a bunch of Cary Thornley materials that I was going to trying to acquire from him before he died that I never did get a handle on. I'm not sure what they were. So, you know, he was one of the many people I'd talked to. Like, you know, I said I corresponded to Thornley and Jim Keyes and Ron Bonds and that whole network out there of people involved in the conspiracy scene that kind of had a similar sensibility about it, you know.
Yeah.
Jim Keith and I feel we were kind of kindred spirits in a sense, the way we approach, you know, subject matter.
Now, how did you take his death? Well, you must have been pretty heartbroken when you heard he died.
Well, it was just one of those things. Here we go again, you know.
Yeah. Now, are you, I guess now it's been like maybe 8 years or something like that since he died. What do you think of the idea that maybe it was a conspiracy to kill him and or Ron Bonds? Is there much to that, you think, or is that the sort of thing where when someone in the conspiracy field dies, that you know, it's almost automatically going to be blamed on their work?
Well, you know, there's no particular smoking gun.
Yeah.
But, you know, it seemed pretty damn curious to me, you know, especially... Once again, we talked about Bonds was the main publisher of Jim Keith. They both worked closely together on different projects. Keith had just become a partner with Ron Bonds, you know, at the time of his death. They put out some pretty controversial material through Illuminate Press, like the book The Octopus.
Oh, yeah, that's a great book.
And that's, you know, I worry about my friend Ken Thomas was the co-author of that book with Jim Keith.
Yeah.
Ken's really somebody who's talked about their deaths and looked into it more than I have.
Yeah.
But he thinks there was probably something sinister behind it all.
Now, yeah, you're pretty much colleagues then with Ken Thomas too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what's he's written a lot of great books, and he's a pretty big name in the conspiracy research field. What
he's America's most beloved conspiracy theorist. Actually, he prefers to be called a parapolitical researcher.
I like that a lot better. I might have to adopt that as well.
And his motto is all conspiracy, no theory.
Oh, that's even better. I like that. Would you consider him like a friend of yours? You guys are or colleagues, correspondents, and stuff like that.
Yeah, we've met before. Once again, he's involved with a network of you know, the Greg Bishop and Rob Sterling at Conformist.com. You know, we've met up a few times. I'm forgetting that. Few of the folks, but we have these conspiracy conclaves now and then.
Nice, I hear you going.
Yeah.
Now, do you think, now obviously, Ken Thomas, he must be worried because these two dudes just up and died.
I don't know if he is. I think he's of the sentiment that, hey, you can't look back over your shoulder. He has a passion and love for what he's doing. So
yeah, that's cool.
You know, you're either going to do what you felt you were put here to do or do it and be unhappy and might as well be dead anyway.
Yeah, you can't back down anyway when, you know, even if something like that happened to them, even if they were offed, you can't really, you know, then if you stop, then that's what, you know, part of the reason probably why they did it.
Yeah, and you lose if they're able to scare you or spook you out of doing what you want to do, then they, quote-unquote, they have won.
Now, in that sort of like network of people where there's always these sort of mysterious deaths, and you seem like you're more well-connected with that community than I am, do you think there is sort of like an undercurrent, I wouldn't say a fear, but of, you know, hey, live now because you never know. You might write the thing that gets you killed. No, you know, your next project could be the one that, that, you know, seals your fate type of attitude.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
I think that's back there in the background. I don't know if any of us dwell upon that, but, you know, it's a possibility, especially after the deaths of Keith and Barnes. And, you know, the book The Octopus was based on Danny Casolaro, who, you know, allegedly or suicided, but I think we all know better.
Yeah. Now, do you know him at all?
No.
Ah. Okay, and then that pretty much wraps it up for the Kerry Thorne book. I had one other question for you outside of all of this was I didn't really see too much other than the George Bush article in The Beast of. I didn't see too much discussion on 9/11, so as a conspiracy theory, parapolitical researcher.
I prefer to be called a crackpot historian.
Okay, here we go. As a crackpot historian, you know, you were in this field way before 9/11, and 9/11 happened. That's sort of like, I think it really just was a huge, major event, obviously, in the lives of everybody in the world.
Oh, yeah.
And especially for conspiracy theorists, because, you know, I mean, that probably was the biggest event since the JFK assassination, and we know what the JFK assassination is, has spurned as far as conspiracy theory go. What do you think about 9/11, and what, you know, what were your thoughts when it happened, and in retrospect now, like 4 or 5 years later, what do you think?
Well, when it happened, I was, it was a mind blower, obviously, like it was to everybody else.
Yeah.
It was one of those events like the JFK assassination, or when John Lennon was killed. You remember exactly, you know, where you were at when you heard about it and what you were doing, one of those type things. So, you know, it's a life-changing experience. You know, as far as the particulars behind it, I haven't really investigated it too closely. I mean, there's a lot of other people involved in that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, we talked about the revelation of the method, or a strategy of tension being created, and that was obviously a prime opportunity if it was orchestrated by a conspiracy. You know, it definitely helped achieve the design of a New World Order, call it what you want, stripping us of certain rights and helping us get closer to a police state. You know, and the same thing that happened with the Kennedy assassination. So without talking about the particulars or, you know, behind 9/11, you can look behind that and, you know, see the same earmarks or design behind a lot of things, like the Oklahoma City bombing and all these other events that happen. You know, there's the distinct possibility that there was a design behind it. It wasn't necessarily something that was created by,
Fundamentalist
terrorists.
Now, do you think we're heading towards a new world order, or is it sort of a mood in society that sort of is a permanent feeling? That, like you said, it was, they were saying that back in the 60s and 70s, and now they're sort of saying it now. Do you think that they've always been saying it, and they'll be saying it like 20 years from now, and we still be relatively free?
In 20 years, maybe, you know, you definitely, if you travel around the world, you see the globalization going on.
Yeah.
I was in China a few months ago, and, you know, it's like going to a major city out here in the West somewhere. You have all the Gucci ads and all this type of stuff. There's this global commercialization that I think is all part of this, call it what you want, one world design to basically, strip us of our culture and, you know, all that's really important to us all, you know, what's at the core of civilization. And homogenize it into this, basically commercialized society.
Yeah.
You know, do their shopping at the strip malls and Walmart World. And,
all right.
Sadly enough.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
Hey, you got to create your own world, you know?
Yeah, pretty much. You got to go your own way, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And what future projects can we look forward to hearing from you on? What are we going to see coming down the pipeline from Adam Gilroy?
We talked about James Shelby Downard, whose influence on Michael Anthony Hoffman.
Yeah, you touched on it a little bit, yeah.
So, yeah, a piece about the stuff they've done. I mean, I get into Michael Hoffman as well in this piece, and
awesome.
William Grimstad, who's part of this group, is talking about this whole mythology, perhaps, or whatever they've created in their works, you know, dealing with all these themes on the revelation of the method.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's either going to be a long article or a short book. And there's other things in kind of on the back burner. I'm thinking of writing another article kind of exclusively on this whole Tuesday Will Illuminati high weirdness.
Yeah.
And,
nice.
Yeah, there's always something.
Awesome. Awesome.
Yeah.
And so, that'll just be coming out sometime around whenever.
I'll let you know. I'll put you on my mailing list. How's that sound?
Sounds good. Nice. And I'll spread the word.
You don't mind being spammed?
What's that?
If you don't mind being spammed?
I'm used to it now.
Okay.
Tell the people your website and the books that they can get there, and give them the whole spiel here. Give them the rundown.
Yeah, the easiest way to go to get the books is through adamgorightly.com. And, you know, there's links there to Amazon or whoever to get them. And you also get signed copies if you want to go that route. It doesn't cost you any more. They have the four books on the website. One is the Manson book, The Shadow Over Santa Susana, Black Magic, Mind Control, and the Manson Family Mythos. I had all these long titles in the Carrie Thornley book, The Prankster and the Conspiracy, the story of Carrie Thornley and how he met Oswald and inspired the counterculture. Third book, it's a chat book. It's available also through wingtv.net. They're the publisher. It's called Adam Go Rightly on Death Cults. And lastly, The Beast of Adam Go Rightly, Collected Rantings, 1992 through 2004. Those are all available on the AdamGoRightly.com website. I also have a second website devoted exclusively to the Manson book, which is MansonMythos.com.
Nice. Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, definitely check out the books, everybody. I really enjoyed them. The two I read so far, I'm going to be picking up the other one soon. And I'm sure I'm going to like those a lot, too, because I just really dug into the Beast of and the Prankster and the Conspiracy. Those are both great, and I highly recommend the books. And thank you very much, Adam Go Rightly, for stopping into Banal of America Audio. I hope you enjoyed the interview, and I'm sure the people who listen are going to really dig in and enjoy the conversation we had.
Yeah, thank you.
That does it for this week's edition of Banal of America Audio. I want to thank Adam Go Rightly for sitting down and talking to us. I want to thank Leslie and Chiron of BanalofAmerica.com for your help and support with the audio series. And, of course, I want to thank all you great listeners out there in the internet world. Hope you're enjoying the audio series. Stay tuned for more madness from BanalofAmerica.com. You can find more stuff from us at www.binnalofamerica.com. Next week, it is to be announced. You have no idea. I am taping two monstrously huge interviews 24 hours from now. I will announce who will be the first of those two guests to be featured sometime next week at banalofamerica.com. And, of course, next Saturday, be here for the first of those two interviews. I can't tell you who they are yet. I don't like to announce any names until the interviews are in the can, so you're not disappointed if someone bails at the last minute. But I will simply say that these two gentlemen I will be speaking to tomorrow in two separate interviews are both giants in the field of ufology, so I think you're going to freak out when you see who is on tap for the rest of December at Banal of America Audio Season 1. So, while you think of that, enjoy the rest of your week. You'll be hearing from me next Saturday. This is Tim Banal, signing off.